Okay, I'm going to go over this because I don't want to go back over these two things again, so we're going to hit them right now. So if you can look over here at my computer, I think we're going to get to this tonight. My goal is that. Can everybody kind of see this?
Yeah.
Okay. This is Jericho, because we're going to be eventually getting to Jericho. This distance from when it's, so this kind of shows you Jericho's not quite a rectangle. It's, I don't know what you call that. It's almost more like an ellipsis. But it says 1,497 feet for about 1,500 feet from one end to the other, and about 525 feet across. So it kind of gives you a perspective. They say it's equivalent to like 6 acres, equivalent to 7 city blocks, kind of give you a perspective. That's what Jericho proper was. And this is the excavation. So this you can kind of see. This is Jericho right in here.
So when they would march around and take them a full day, it was just, there were so many people, it took them a day to walk around. And they marched.
Well, in reading it, I don't know that it took them all day. They just did it, but they went around once a day is what they did. Yeah. Actually, there's a lot of things when you go through and read the account of Jericho that I'm going, oh. And the thing is, we've read through this multiple times, reading through the scriptures, but there were things that occurred to me in studying this time that I had never thought of, things that I guess I'd always assumed growing up. So with this, yes, oh, they're right here on the center table. Okay, this is the big conquest, Joshua and the conquest of the land of Canaan. And really what this study is going to do is, this study on your page, we're basically going to cover the whole book of Joshua. Is what we're going to do. I'm trying to kind of, if you remember, we're trying to pick some of the big stories. And I realize I'm making a judgment call when I do that, because you might think, well, why didn't you choose this story? Because this is a big story too. But I'm making a judgment call and I'm picking some big stories. And we've walked through, you know, creation. We've walked through the fall. We've looked at the flood and promises to Abraham and all these different, and now we get down here to God fulfilling the promise that started with Abraham, was reiterated to Isaac and Jacob, Joseph, reiterated to the fathers in Egypt, and now they've come, our last study was looking at Kadesh Barnea, where they had sent the spies in. In other words, really what our last study ended about 40 years before this study. Well, it was 40 years, not about, it was 40 years earlier. And they wandered around in the desert. And so, why this story? We always ask that question. Why did I? Because this is really what it is. Some of these are real obvious, but sometimes, why did I choose this as one of the big stories that I thought would be helpful for us? Number one, again, and we've reiterated, we said this several times, it demonstrates that God's promises of land were intended literally. However you want to put that down, God meant those promises literally. And now he's given them the land. So there's one. Give me time to write that in. Number two, it undermines allegorical and spiritual application of God's promises to Abraham. It undermines allegorical interpretation because it shows these promises were literal. So it's kind of, number two is a restatement of number one, but from a different perspective. Now, having said that, I'll point out that you would be surprised at how many people over the years I've heard say this and how many commentaries I pick up that say Joshua is the Ephesians of the Old Testament. In fact, Merrill Unger, who was a dispensationalist like us, Merrill Unger actually wrote that Exodus to Deuteronomy, are typological of the redemption of Christ. Joshua, then, is equivalent to Ephesians because it shows settling into the land is about encouraging you to go to your position in Christ. That's all typology, see? So even though Merrill Unger is a dispensationalist and approaches Scripture literally, he's actually being allegorical by the way he applies this. Another group said Deuteronomy is parallel to Acts. So doesn't it make sense then that Joshua should parallel another book since Joshua follows Deuteronomy? Hebrews parallels Leviticus, and I just don't see it. In fact, one of these people said Joshua and Ephesians, or they're both about the same theme, possessing our possessions. Israel's possessing their possessions, and Ephesians calling us to possess our possessions in Christ. And some of them say it's about spiritual victory. This is about victory in the land. Ephesians is about our spiritual victory. That all of that really is kind of a, it's, let's put it this way, it's a stretch. It really is a form of allegory. I don't know that you would naturally come to that conclusion in reading Joshua specifically. I wouldn't. If I didn't read that in other books, I don't know that I would ever come to the conclusion that it's a parallel to the book of Ephesians. I'm just saying that. Number three, last one, it supports the precedent set in the Mosaic Law. This is a long answer, but so you might want to word it a little bit differently. But it supports the precedent set in the Mosaic Law that God was to be feared and his laws and instructions were to be taken seriously. Or to put it in simple terms, you might want to say, it sets down the fact that the law was to be taken literally, taken seriously. I do not think we'll get far enough to show that example of that tonight. So that's going to take us a little while into this study. So, with that, let's take a look at the background, how the book starts, Joshua chapter 1. I'm enjoying these studies. I hope you're enjoying these. I'm enjoying them because to me, it's good to be reminded this is our God. He may not be doing these same things for us, but this is our God. And so Joshua chapter 1, it says in verses 1 and 2, "Now it came about after the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord, that the Lord spoke to Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' servant, saying, 'Moses, my servant is dead. Now therefore arise, cross the Jordan, you and all this people, to the land which I am giving to them, to the sons of Israel. And every place on which the sole of your foot treads, I have given it to you, just as I spoke to Moses, from the wilderness," that's the south, "and this Lebanon," that's on the east side of the Jordan, "even as far as the great river, the river Euphrates," that's to the north, "and all the land of the Hittites, even as far as the great sea," that'd be the Mediterranean, "toward the setting of the sun will be your territory. And no man will be able to stand before you all the days of your life. Just as I have been with Moses, I will be with you. I will not fail you or forsake you. So be strong and courageous, for you shall give this people possession of the land which I swore to their fathers to give them. Be strong and courageous. Be careful to do according to all the law which Moses, my servant, commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right or to the left, so that you may have success wherever you go. This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do according to all that is written in it, for then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have success. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Do not tremble or be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go." And so we start off with some of these interesting, or these points. Number one, Moses has died, that you have there. Second of all, God instructed Joshua to lead the people. Joshua is the one that's going to be taking the lead. He also indicates that Joshua is going to be the leader. And in fact, if you are keeping your finger here, flip over to chapter 4 in verse 14. This is when they go across the Jordan. And in verse 14, and it says, "And on that day the Lord exalted Joshua in the sight of all Israel, so that they revered him, just as they had revered Moses all the days of his life." And we're gonna kind of go through that story in a little bit more detail. But if you remember in our last study, God, we made reference to this out of the book of 1 Corinthians. God said all Israel was baptized into Moses by what two things?
The parting of the Red Sea
and the cloud, the pillar of cloud. Okay, so they were under those things, and God used those to demonstrate Moses is the man. What parallel is there in what happens in this chapter for asserting that that now Joshua is taking over the leadership that once Moses had?
Cross
the Jordan on dry ground, and in this way, the same way that God pointed out to the people of Israel, Moses really is the man. In this same way, now God is asserting Joshua is really man. And he tells us right here in verse 14 of chapter 4 that God exalted him that day in the sight of Israel. Exalted him in what way? That he's affirming that he's to be their leader. Now, keep in mind, let's just ask you a question here. See if anybody of you can get a good guess. How old was Joshua when the book of Joshua picks up?
I have to say he has to be over 60.
Right.
Okay,
because he's a young man. He's a young man as an attendant to Moses. Okay. But he's old enough that he sends him out to be one of the spies. So I would say he's probably 20 or above. But he's still considered a young man at that time, so he's probably closer to 20 than too far off. 40 years have passed, so he has to be at least 60 at this point then.
60.
So he has to be at least 60 years old, okay? We're going to run into another guy before we're done. We won't do it tonight, but we're going to run into another guy that's in his 80s.
So this is a pastoral epistle. They don't lay hands suddenly on any man for leadership.
Right? That's right.
Sorry.
That's all right. That's all right. Fourth, I guess, do I have four of these? I do have four of these for you, that God promised success in taking the land. We saw that back there in chapter 1. Also, God warned them to obey the law, and God warned them not to abandon the law. Not, don't let these words depart from your mouth. That would have been an abandonment, so they warned them to abandon the law. So he warned them to obey the law, warned them not to abandon the law. All those things were very important as they go into the land, because, and this again goes back to kind of what we said, God's laid down the law for Israel, and they're expected to keep it, and the blessing is tied to obeying the law at this time. That's, and remember, that's really the difference between living by grace. I was just listening to somebody talk about this the other day, and I don't think they fully got this right. The real difference between living by grace and being under the dispensation of grace and being under the dispensation of law is, under law, you got blessings by obeying. Under grace, you don't earn things by obedience, number one. And number two, you already have all blessings by grace. And you can't lose those blessings because you're under grace. So there's a difference. So now we get on to chapter 2 and verse 1. And we're going to look at the spying of the land in Jericho. We have a... It says in verse 1, and then Joshua the son of Nun sent two men as spies secretly from Shittim, saying, go view the land, especially Jericho. So they went and came into the house of a prostitute whose name was Rahab, and they lodged there. Notice in the first part of that verse, it said he sent out two men as spies secretly. Kind of almost sounds redundant, doesn't it? Has anybody said, we're sending a spy to you, we're sending a spy over there? Why does he say here that he sent out spies secretly? Well, what happened last time they sent spies out?
Didn't go well.
10 of the spies came and brought poor reports. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not saying this is the case because it's not specifically stated here, but it's been suggested that the reason it states in the text he sent the spies secretly was that Joshua didn't want to send spies out this time and tell everybody else, everybody going, well, what happened? What'd you see? Well, we saw this huge city. Didn't want to do that. Didn't want to put him in that position. Again, that's just a suggestion by commentators comparing this to what happened at Kadesh Barnea the first time. It may or may not be the case. The next thing that's just to point out in here, which this is one of the things that makes us maybe uncomfortable in our modern culture, but they stayed at the house of a prostitute whose name was Rahab, and they lodged there. The word that's translated in the New American Standard, lodge, is literally a word meaning to lie down. And most frequently in the Old Testament, when it meant lie down, it meant to lie down for the purpose of engaging in what you do at a place like that. Whether that is what God intended, that is what he did choose that word, although our Bibles have translated lodge. Part of the problem is, frequently that's the way inns were. When you went and stayed at a person that put people up, since usually it was men that traveled, families didn't normally travel like this. It was usually men in Israel that would travel, that this was kind of, now we look at that and we find that offensive. It wasn't prohibited under the law, by the way. What was prohibited under the law was going to what they called cult prostitutes, those that served the different temples and altars. It's wrong for us, specifically under the dispensation of grace. It doesn't fit the character God wants, but God didn't prohibit it under the law. he prohibited adultery, but adultery was always something with a married woman when you had it under the law. So it was a different situation. I just point that out because I think it's good for us to sometimes dislodge our Victorian ideas that we force upon the Word of God, and then when we start reading, you come across some things that are in there. We're going, I don't remember being. Well, that's because you don't teach some of those things in Sunday school to the 5 and the 6 year olds because they don't need to know that. But we honestly should be able to read our Bibles with open eyes and see some of the things that go on. But this is where they stay. It says in verse 2. Now, there's what's interesting about this. Despite whatever you might think about Rahab's character and her occupation and what goes on here, what is very interesting is to read what it says in the following verses. And it was told the king of Jericho, saying, "Behold, men from the sons of Israel have come here tonight to search out the land." And the king of Jericho sent then word to Rahab, saying, "Bring out the men who have come to you, who have entered your house, for they have come to search out the land." And the woman had taken the two men and hidden them. And she said, "Yes, the men came to me, but I did not know where they came from." And it came about that it was when they were about to shut the gate at dark that the men went out. "I do not where the men went. Pursue them quickly, for you will overtake them." Problem. So we've got a couple we call moral problems from a modern perspective. One was her occupation. Number two, moral problem is she lied. And there are people that come to this and say, see, the Bible teaches situational ethics. Lies okay if the lie serves a good purpose. For you and I today, in the dispensation of grace, lying is inconsistent with operating by the doctrine of the truth. But the law, again, the law didn't prohibit lying. What did the law actually say? Don't bear false witness. False witness is saying, "I saw Ben steal that donkey." That's what bearing false witness was. What she actually, plus, on top of that, what is she not? She's not a Jew. Yeah, which means she's not under the law. So there's a couple of things in there. Number one, the law didn't prohibit lying. And number two, that doesn't say that lying's okay. But remember, God's not keeping a tally of it. The book of Romans tells us one of the reasons God gave the law, was to actually keep a tally of sin. But she lies. Then it says in verse 6, "But she had brought them up to the roof and hidden them in the stalks of flax, which she had laid in order on the roof." They laid flax out to dry because then they would go and they would peel flax apart, they'd beat it up, and they'd make linen out of it. To this day, if you buy real linen, it's made out of flax fiber. And that's probably what they were doing, is that she'd probably gone out, they'd probably harvested some flax, she laid it out and had to let it go through its drying process. So she's laying on the roof, and she's hidden them under all these stalks of flax on the roof of her house. Most of you all know this story. So the men pursued them on the road to Jordan, to the fords, and as soon as those who were pursuing them had gone out, they shut the gate. Now, before they laid down, same word that we had back up in verse 1, she came up to them on the roof and said, "I know." Now, this is important, verse 9. "I know that Jehovah," that's who she's talking about. That's why you have Lord in all capitals, "has given you the land, and that the terror of you has fallen on us, and that all the inhabitants of the land have melted away before you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the waters of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, and to Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. And when we heard it, our hearts melted, and there was no courage remained in any man any longer because of you. For the Jehovah your God, he is God in heaven above and on earth beneath." Look at this. Here is a Gentile woman, a woman from our perspective that she would say has a disreputable occupation. And yet in this city, she's the woman that recognizes Jehovah's the real God. And she knows these people in Jericho, as well as her, they know the history. They've heard the stories of what God had did. The reports had gotten around. I think that's all very important for us to kind of get a perspective on this. The king knew this, and Rahab knew this. All of them knew this history. And she was convinced that God was the God of heaven. She was convinced that God was going to give the land to these people. She doesn't tell us that she has any revelation from God, that God's come down. Doesn't say God had come down and told her this. She just knew this from what had, from the reports that had gone on about what are these people. Well, they believe that their God's bringing them land. And she's going, hey, everything that he's been doing for them, well, yeah, he is going to do it. This is the real God.
This would be like Peter, though. He goes, who am I? And God, he tells him, well, God the Father told you this. He made it real to you.
Yeah, and I don't doubt that. I don't doubt that. But what I'm saying is that God had not showed up and told her, you know, face-to-face this revelation. Yeah. She had, by God's work, been able to deduce from what she observed and what she had heard what was going on. This is all very important.
It gives validity. Validity to what Moses was responding to God when God told Moses he was offering to annihilate Israel and start all over again, and Moses said no because the nations that will blaspheme you on account of that, and it shows that the nations were aware of what was going on. So.
Yeah, they were watching. Well, think about this: for 40 years, these people have just basically been moving their livestock around. Down there in the wilderness, for 40 years this has been going on, and people, you think after 40 years people would be wondering, what are they doing down there? What did they? Their God's bringing them. What?
Yeah, manna.
Yeah, yeah. Fed every exactly.
So you're saying in verse okay, so the verse in verse 8, the word lay was the same word as verse 1 lodged. You saying?
Yeah.
Okay. So right. The second one is the context. The second one is not sexual. If they're hiding under the flags. You're saying in the context of the first one,
well,
it could be.
But that's the thing, is they don't know, because there's certain things that go with that, that some commentators are honest with the text, saying that this is, you know, this
but,
is
I mean,
what was
but,
going
but
on.
The
but
second
I,
one, I can see the first one, you wouldn't know, but the second one, it sounds like, they're before she came up there on the roof, they're hiding under this flax, right, they're laying down on the, am I reading that wrong now, before they laid down.
Yeah.
So they're laying down to be covered by this flax, though, right? Is that what the...
No, that's not. That's not. It's just...
What's the same?
It's before all this happens, because she sent them away. She's just coming up there to tell them what's going on.
Okay, so you're saying it's a possibility, but we don't know.
Yeah,
what,
yeah.
Don't know
and
what
I,
saying that.
Yeah, exactly. But it doesn't say that specifically. Yeah. Like I've said, most of the time that's the way this occurs. But I could contend this may be an exception to the rule. But we can't demand it, saying, well, these men were so moral, they never would have done anything like that. Well, I don't know that we can necessarily say that. We saw what God did through Judah and his activities at that time. We just, like I said, we read scriptures a lot of times with rose-colored glasses. We don't oftentimes read them for what they say. And the scriptures actually are very bold sometimes in the things that it actually states. Most of us know the remainder of this, where she is so convinced of this. It says now in verse 12, now therefore please swear to me by the Lord, since I have dealt kindly with you, that you also will deal kindly with my father's household and give me then a pledge or give me some sort of a token of this. Spare my father, my mother, my brothers, my sisters, with all that belong to them, and deliver our lives from death. And of course, we know then they're told they need to stay.
Is that token there supposed to be assigned?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So she wanted some sort of a sign to guarantee that this is going to happen. You remember what they say. Now, there's two things, and there was another picture I didn't pull up that shows that the walls of Jericho, they think what when they've excavated that this that there were two walls on here. That there's the main wall like this, and then there's a berm on the outside of the wall that's sloped with a lower wall that kind of gave strength to this to the main wall. And so some have wondered if her house wasn't built on this lower wall that was like a 12-foot wall that was on the outside, this lower wall that was held up the berm, because they had a rock wall down here and then a mud brick wall on top of that. Wherever it's at, her house is on the side. She lets him down through a window on the outside of the wall. It sounds kind of odd to us to have a wall with some windows in it, but that's the way these cities were built. Because remember, the main purpose, people lived in those cities, but really what these walled cities did was all these people lived on farms out in the country. And what would happen is with something like this would take place with Israel coming and now they're threatened, what would happen? You'd vacate your farm, and you'd all run, and you crowd into these cities. So normally you didn't have the same population. They Jericho at this time probably had a larger population than it had normally, because most of these people were living out on farms in the surrounding area. Okay, so now we have this large population. Remember, the purpose of Wallen, it was basically to create like a giant citadel, because every one of these cities had its own king, and it kind of governed its own little mini kingdom right around there. With all that, then if we move on down to chapter 3, we got to get Israel into the land for this. And this is one of the next places that that there was something that kind of caught me a little bit by surprise. Well, we do have the scarlet cord. We should remind that in verse 21 back up there in chapter 2. And she said, according to your words, so be it. So she sent them away and they departed, and she tied the scarlet cord in the window. They said, as long as that cord's there and we see it, then you'll be rescued. But now we go down to chapter 3, and it says in verse 1, then Joshua rose early in the morning, and he and all the sons of Israel set out from Shittim and came to the Jordan, and they lodged there before they crossed. Came about at the end of 3 days that the officers went through the midst of the camp. They commanded the people, saying, when you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God with the Levitical priest carrying it, then you shall set out from your place to go after it. However, there shall be between you and it a distance of about 2,000 cubits by measure. Do not come near it, that you may know the way by which you shall go, for you have not passed this way before. Then Joshua told the people to consecrate, or literally set yourselves apart. It's a verb form of the word make of holy. And then if you go on down, it says, and I'm just trying to think of the next word. Go down to verse 14. So it came about when the people set out from their tents to cross the Jordan, that with the priests carrying the Ark of the Covenant before the people, and when those who carried the Ark came into the Jordan, and the feet of the priests carrying the Ark were dipped in the edge of the water, for the Jordan, now this is important, the Jordan overflows all its banks all the days of harvest. Why is that in there? They're going to go on dry land, but why is that little parenthetical statement? For the Jordan overflows all its banks all the days of harvest.
There's a lot of water.
Yeah. We're talking about it's in a high water season, not a low water season. Why is that important? Makes the miracle even all that much greater. There have been people that, I've listened to different people that said, oh, it probably was a dry season and they had a trickle and, you know, they threw a few rocks up there and dammed it up and went across in a trickle season. And I don't know that the Jordan ever trickles. I've heard that it doesn't flow like it once did, because they take a lot of water out of it for irrigation these days. But what this is telling us is they're crossing at harvest season and there's a lot of water flowing. And yet when they did this, it says in verse 16 that the waters which were flowing down from above stood and rose up in one heap a great distance away at Adam, the city that is beside Zarethan, and those which were flowing down toward the sea of the Arabah, the salt sea, were completely cut off so that the people crossed opposite Jericho. By the way, where they're crossing is approximately 5 miles from Jericho. That's what I've measured when I've looked at this and I've read. Does that sound? Did you guys see Jericho when you were there? Didn't go there. Okay.
So both, we were in the, wasn't that the river with David though?
Jordan,
but we were in the same location.
Okay.
It was cold.
So 5 miles would be approximately like going from, if you're out on the highway, from going from the Shell station to just past the road where Dan and Angie live on. I think that's about 5 miles there. No, that's not. That's not. That's more like four. What? Dan and Angie, you'd have to go past that another mile. You'd have to go past that one another mile.
Yeah, like Adams.
So, yeah, from Royal City, if you went to Adams, it'd be five. Yeah. Anyway, just trying to give you a perspective about how far they are. And so they cross on dry land. When they're done, chapter 4, just to remind ourselves of this, they are commanded that each one, they're supposed to have a man from each one of the 12 tribes, is supposed to take a rock. They pile them in there, and they do so, it tells us in the scriptures, as a sign. And it says in verse 21, and he said to the sons of Israel, this is chapter 4, 21, said to the sons of Israel, when your children ask their fathers in time to come, saying, what are these stones? Well, then you shall inform your children, saying, Israel crossed this Jordan on dry ground. For the Lord your God dried up the waters of the Jordan before you until you had crossed, just as the Lord your God had done to the Red Sea, which he dried up before us until we had crossed. That all the peoples of the earth may know that the hand of the Lord is mighty, so that you may fear the Lord your God forever. And fear is not reverential respect. It's actually to actually treat him with real fear, to realize he is not a God to be trifled with. Okay. So they take the stones, and I've got a couple of statements in there that you can kind of fill in on what they were doing there. But then they come to this, they also have this next matter that in chapter 5 they have to circumcise, and they have to do this because if you'd look in verses, begin with verse 2, it says, at that time the Lord said to Joshua, this is chapter 5, verse 2, the Lord said to Joshua, make for yourself flint knives and circumcise again the sons of Israel the second time. Now, the reason he says the second time is because they also did this when they came out of Egypt. So now this is the second time, but this is the next generation, mind you. So Joshua made himself flint knives and circumcised the sons of Israel at Gibeath Haraloth. So think about it. Everybody from 20 down to 1 that had when... at Kadesh Barnea, most of them had been circumcised. But see, now during the 40 years of wilderness, we're going to find out, it says in verse 5, for all the people who came out were circumcised, but all the people who were born in the wilderness during the 40 years, so you can have people 40 years old, along the way as they came out of Egypt had not been circumcised, and they need to do this. Now, why was circumcision important? Because in Genesis 17, we have the verses down there if you want to look at, God had told them, to be a part of the people that are going to inherit the promise, you need to circumcise every male. And so for them to be those that could that were would be part of the people that could inherit the promise, they needed to practice this. This is what God was doing. It was the sign. It was the sign of this covenant that God had made. And you can go back and look at those things in Genesis 17. We've looked at those before. Yes. I've got the verses right there on the sheet. Then if you look in also in chapter 5 and verse 10, one of the other things, it says, and while the sons of Israel camped at Gilgal, they observed the Passover.
Okay.
So go back and we're going to start reading with verse 10. And while the sons of Israel camped at Gilgal, they observed the Passover on the evening of the 14th day of the month on the desert plains of Jericho. And on the day after the Passover, on that very day, they ate some of the produce of the land, unleavened cakes and parched grain. And the manna ceased on the day after they had eaten some of the produce of the land, so that the sons of Israel no longer had manna, but they ate some of the yield of the land of Canaan during that year. So remember, they've been eating manna now for about 42 years that they've been eating manna, and now it ceased the very day that they first eat the produce of the land, which is really what God was going to do. He was going to take care of them during all this time and guarantee that they were going to get what they needed. Now, continue on down here. Any questions so far? We're taking big strides. We're running. Okay, so in chapter 5, then immediately after that, it says in verse 13, now it came about when Joshua was by Jericho that he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, there was a man was standing opposite him with a sword drawn in his hand. Joshua went to him and said to him, are you for us or for our adversaries? And he said, no. Rather, I indeed come now as captain of the host of the Lord, or army of the Lord. This is a zavak in the Hebrew, which is, oh, our Bible's always called Lord of Hosts. Literally, it's Lord of Armies. So that's what this word is. It's army. I am the captain of the army of the Lord. Joshua fell on his face to the earth, bowed down, and said to him, what has my Lord said to his servant? And the captain of the Lord's host said to Joshua, remove your sandals from your feet, for the place where you are standing is holy. And Joshua did so. Two things about this. if you were to go over to the book of Revelation, when angels appear to John and John falls down before him, what do the angels tell John? Get up. Don't do that. I'm a fellow servant. This one never says that to Joshua. Why? Because this is not a fellow servant. This is God. And not only that, but what's the other parallel in here? Take off your sandals. The feet you're standing on. What God did with
Moses.
Yeah. So it's the same kind of introduction here to Joshua that God had to Moses, except that was at a burning bush. But the same thing. The ground you're standing on is holy. Take your sandals off. This is God the Son. This is the pre-incarnate Son of God appearing as a real man, but he's the captain. Notice he's the one that's in charge of the armies of Jehovah. He's the one that's going to be leading, that leads those armies. And I don't believe when it says armies of Jehovah, it's talking about the armies of Israel. I believe it's referring to the angelic armies.
Take down walls?
Well, yes, exactly. There. Exactly. Now, he gives him instructions. We come to chapter 6, and he gives instructions. Says, now Jericho was tightly shut because of the sons of Israel. Could you imagine? Remember when they left Israel, of course, remember there's a whole generation that died out in the wilderness, but nonetheless, kids were being born, and the nation has continued to grow. So we're talking about a few million people, if you remember from our study when they came out of Egypt. So now you think about this, you've got a few million people that have just crossed the Jordan. What are you going to do? You're going to get inside the city. You're going to pull all the people out of off their farms. Everybody's going to come inside. You're going to shut the doors and lock them up, put the bars in the doors, and you're going to make sure that you are ready for a siege. It's estimated by looking at you saw the pictures of the city. They've estimated by looking at the size of the city that normally Jericho probably had about a population of about 1,200. But they figured during a siege, when all these people went in, that they may have had a population of a few thousand. Because you would have had quite a few people in the outlying areas that farmed and such that would have moved into the city. Think about that. Let's say you have 6,000 people in the city. What is that compared to a few million? Of course, not all those millions are going to fight against you. Who's going to fight against you? They're armed men. The Hebrew calls it the Gevor men, the strong men. They're the ones that are going to come in battle. And interestingly enough, if you look at this, look what it says. So Jericho was tightly shut because the sons of Israel, no one went out, no one came in. And the Lord said to Joshua, see, I have given Jericho into your hand. Remember, because he's talking with Jehovah at the end of chapter 15. I have given Jericho into your hand with its king and the valiant warriors. You shall march around the city. Now notice this. Who marched around the city? It says, all the men of war. Those are the men 20 years old and upward that are fit for war. Those are the ones that were done in the census. For some reason, I'm not for sure why, but since I was a little kid, I always saw everybody marching around the city. Mom, dad, little kids, all marching around the city. But in reality, it was their fighting men, which numbered probably in the hundreds of thousands, if not a million of them at this time. So that's a sizable group of guys marching around a city. That may have, what, 5,000 or 6,000 people packed in there, perhaps?
You probably got to circle around the whole perimeter.
Exactly.
Small city.
Yeah, and that's marching around there, marching perhaps several men abreast. Yeah, in some sort of a formation. But you're going to march around the city, all the men of war circling the city once, and you shall do so for 6 days. Also, 7 priests shall carry 7 trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. Then on the 7th day you shall march around the city 7 times, and the priests shall blow the trumpets. And it shall be that when they make the long blast of the ram's horns, and when you hear the sound of the trumpet, all the people shall shout with a great shout. Now the question is that everybody doing that? Because he doesn't say the men of war. They're marching. This is my conclusion. The men are the ones that are marching around the city, but everybody else is out there. They're just not marching. And because he switches from the men of war to people... To the eem here, I take that to, or the yeah the people. I take that to mean that hey, you're back in the camp, and when you hear those guys blow their horns on this, you all are shouting, even the whole camp. I may be wrong on that. It might just be a reference to the men, but he doesn't use the word men. He switches to the word people.
Well, it would be in keeping with all the people need to have faith that God's going to do this, not just the army.
Yes, So all the people shall shout with a great shout, and the wall of the city will fall down flat. And then notice it says all the people will go up, every man, and it does say man here, every man straight ahead. This is what some people suggest, that this is why, are you asking the women and children to run in and raid the city, or are you just the armies again? Again, this is a hard call to make. But notice it says they all go straight ahead. Don't zigzag, don't deviate. You just all, wherever you're at, you turn and you run straight into the city, is what they're going to do. Which is telling you what? That these people are really surrounding, exactly like you said, they're all surrounding the city, and they all can run up all the way around it. So Joshua the son of Nun called the priests and said to them, take up the Ark of the Covenant. And then this is exactly what they do. They obey. There is one other instruction in here that I want to make sure we get in here. Go down to verse 12. So Joshua rose early in the morning, and the priest took up the Ark of the Lord, and the seven priests carrying the trumpets, and they go through this process, and... Oh.
Our men went before them?
Go down to verse 17. He gives some special instructions. It says, and the city shall be under the ban. City's under the ban. It and all that is in it belongs to the Lord. Only Rahab the harlot and all who are with her in the house shall live, because she hid the messengers whom we sent. But as for you, only keep yourselves from the things under the ban, lest you covet and take some of the things under the ban, so you would make the camp of Israel accursed and bring trouble on it. But all the silver and gold, articles of bronze and iron, are holy to the Lord. They shall go into the treasury of the Lord.
What verse?
In verse 18, and...
abstain from accursed things, lest you become accursed.
No, verse 18, but as for you, only keep yourself from the things that are under the ban, lest you literally become one that is devoted, one that is set... Oh, accursed, okay.
So it must be accursed.
I'm going to have to take a look at that Hebrew word again. It's not the one I was thinking. So verse 20 says, so the people shouted, they blew the trumpets. It came about when the people heard the sound of the trumpet that the people shouted with a great shout. The wall fell down flat. Literally, it fell right underneath itself. It didn't tip out like this. It just went, it's literally what the word meant. It literally fell down under itself. So it's not a tipping over like this. But what that does, and this is what, if you picture this, if a wall kind of crumbled as it was, it would make, if it tipped out, it might make it hard for you to run into the city. But if it just crumbles in itself, what it does is just make a nice mound for you just to be able to run up and come right over the top of this rubble of the city. Keep in mind, this wall is built out of a combination of rock and mud bricks. A lot of it is mud bricks. So it just kind of all crumbles in this way. Fell down flat, so that the people went up into the city, every man straight ahead, and they took the city. They utterly destroyed everything in the city, both man, woman, young, old, ox, sheep, donkey, with the edge of the sword. And Joshua said to the two men who had spied out the land, go into the harlot's house, bring the woman and all she has out of there, as you have sworn to her. And so the young men who were spies went in, brought Rahab and her father and her mother and her brothers and all she had, and they brought out all her relatives and placed them outside the camp of Israel. And they burned the city with fire and all that was in it, only the silver, the gold, and articles of bronze and iron they put into the treasury of the house of the Lord. However, Rahab the harlot and her father's household and all she had, Joshua spared. And she has lived in the midst of Israel to this day, for she hid the messengers from Joshua, or whom Joshua sent to spy out in Jericho. By the way, who's... great, 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 great grandmother, is she going to become?
Jesus.
Okay, Jesus and David's. Yes. Yeah. I was thinking of David first, David. But yes, Jesus, yes, thank you. Because she's in the genealogy of Jesus, yeah. Yeah. Then Joshua made them take an oath at that time, saying, cursed before the Lord is the man who rises up and builds the city Jericho. With the loss of his firstborn, he shall lay the foundation, and with the loss of his youngest son, he shall set up its gates. And so the Lord was with Joshua, and his fame was in all the land. So again, God is asserting who Joshua is. We'll come back next time and we'll move on because most of them obey, but one man did not obey, and we'll see that next time. There was one man that was disobedient with regard to Jericho.
Well, so did they, in fact, except for Rahab and her family, did they kill every man, woman, and child in the city?
Yeah, it says...
they did.
It's time to
assess. Yeah, it says they utterly destroyed. Verse 21, utterly destroyed everything that was in the city. They didn't leave anything alive.
They did what they were supposed to that time.
Everybody,
a lot of times they went into places and they didn't kill
them. Right. And so they did that, but there was one person that didn't keep everything under the ban, and we'll come back and touch on that next time. The significance of this, just to kind of bring this out, the taking of Jericho is an example in Hebrews 11 of an act of faith. Because what a plan for warfare, you know? How are you going to take the city? We're gonna go out and we're gonna fell some trees and make some battering rams, and then we're gonna make, because a lot of times a lot of these cities down there were built like this, and they actually have writings from ancient times going back that far about how they took these cities. You had big ladders, huge ladders that they would throw up on the sides, and people would scale up the sides of these walls. So people did sack cities that way, but of course that's an uphill battle, real uphill battle. This is one where God. Think of the conundrum that people would find themselves in, having had this big, huge wall on the outside of the thing just fall flat. And plus, they're terrified in the first place. But it was an act of faith on their part to actually go around and to obey what Joshua has said, and for Joshua to be able to take the city in this way.
I think it's also an act of faith on Rahab's family's part. Can you just hear him? Well, we're supposed to stay in this room and put this cord on. Mm-hmm. That'll save us.
Right.
Yeah.
How's that gonna see the city? get out of Dodge.
Yeah. How's that work? So, let's see if I had anything. If there was any other major notes. Nope. I think that's it for tonight. Okay. I kind of calculated this for, because you were talking about how many people. You got a few million men to go around the perimeter of a city that's about 1,500 miles long and its widest point about 560 feet. We're talking about a little over a half mile around. That's immediately. Probably Israel didn't walk right up next to the wall of the city. 1,500 feet. 1,500 feet. I'm sorry. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for correcting me in this.
That's a lot smaller than I had imagined, you know. I always imagined it being bigger, but obviously I had no basis for that.
And weren't they supposed to be quiet? Or does it say that? Or they just were not, they're supposed to shout.
It's on the seventh day that they're supposed to walk around, and they're not, let's see, because the trumpets are blowing as they go.
Is that just the sixth day or every day?
6:14, okay. The second day they marched around the city once, returned to camp, so they did for 6 days.
Days, right. And then the seventh day, they don't shout, they don't say anything.
So verse 6:10, Joshua commanded the people, you shall not shout or make your voice heard, neither shall any word go out of your mouth until the day I tell you.
There's a miracle right there.
Yeah.
Not a word.
Yeah, while they're marching, because
it had to be all men.
Not a word.
what if that's the camp of the people back there, though?
Is that what they were talking about? That was quiet.
I think. Well,
it wouldn't make any difference. There's just no way you could keep that. It's two people together without making it sound much less than a million.
Right.
Shouting in the marching. I'm just saying, it makes me wonder if God used resonance. It was supernatural,
science.
It's supernatural, but God is the one who made science, right? He's the one who made the laws of nature. But you can make things sort of self-destructive. You hit the resonant frequency. You know, like the bridge over on the west side that just tore itself apart because the wind would blow through it at a certain speed, and then it would start to vibrate, and then the vibrations hit a resonant frequency in the structure, and the thing just self-destructs. God did it supernaturally, but I wonder if he used the shouts and the marching to hit the resonant frequency of the wall. It's unbiblical, but it's just curiosity. Yeah. God can use whatever he wants. He could have just had them all be quiet and he could have made it fall down.
Yeah, my wife's over there going.
He's the commander of the army. Think those angels have.
We'll probably have
to do
that.
He wanted them to shout.
Because we do know angels play a role in governments and such. And at the time that they come into the land, you had, yeah, basically had all these city-states. You've got all these fortified cities, and each one has their own king kind of over their own, all these little mini kingdoms all over.
And why identify himself as captain of hosts?
Right.
That didn't play into the situation at all.
Is they going to have this all on video so we can get caught up?
You can't have the Bible on video. It'd be X-rated.
I was telling
it would be a different meaning.
We were talking about movies. I said, you know what, the Bible
would have a sin nature.
X-rated.
Parts of it would be,
The whole Bible.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
But I don't think there's Satan knew the promises that God was giving the Jews that land, and he put giants to try to fortify his position, trying to stop them from coming in.
And there might even in this, we don't know that there was, but I would assume based on other scriptures we have in the Old Testament, there probably even was an angelic conflict that went on in this, in the same way that there were angelic conflicts in other places where cities and nations were overturned.
Spirit of Greece.
There was a day when I wanted to see movies in eternity future of all the history of mankind, but now I'm tired of looking at the unrighteousness of man. I don't see any more of it. Once I'm gone out of here, I'm not saying goodbye to it. But that's just me.
But just as closing, this should go without saying, but just to think about this, the God that did this, parted the waters in Jericho, causes the wall of the city to fall like this, in whatever manner he did it, but he's doing this supernaturally. That's our God. That's our God. He may not have promised me that, you know, if my neighbor builds a huge wall, that God will make it fall down for me. I mean, I know that sounds absurd, but he is our God, and the power that he exhibits in his faithfulness to his promises are as real for us as they were for them.
Still stands, if God be for us, who can be against us?
Yes. So, well, Father, we're thankful for the evening, thankful for the study of your word, for the participation of these individuals here, their interest in appreciating you more, just being reminded of the kind of God that you are and the things that you've done, and being encouraged with your faithfulness in our lives and your power in our lives. And we thank you for this time together then. Amen.